The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we wish to thank them for their support. And we're reading today from the October 2021 edition of Smithsonian. And the cover story is Ode to an Orca. And on the double page inside, it says, In Their Own Element, a photographer takes the plunge into forbidding waters off Norway for an extraordinary encounter with orcas by Pete McBride. And it looks very cold with snow-capped mountains in the background and orcas plying the cold, blue-looking, icy blue-looking water in the foreground. The water is cold inside Norway's northernmost fjords. When I slipped in headfirst, wearing a thick wetsuit, the 40-degree Fahrenheit surface temperature made the water feel dense and biting on my exposed face. Diving down, I found myself crossing a threshold into another world, dark, frigid, seemingly bottomless, and home to giant carnivores that eat fish, seals, and porpoises. If you want to see wild orcas, they can be found in every ocean, from the Arctic to the Antarctic. Despite their killer whale nickname, orcas don't prey on humans, but they're the largest dolphins on the planet, with seven main ecotypes that vary in pigmentation pattern, diet, and sonar dialect. Members of these groups don't usually mate with one another, though scientists are divided on whether to consider them different species. The coast of British Columbia is a popular orca-watching spot. So are Argentina's Valdez Peninsula and Australia's Bremer Bay. But in most countries, there is a limit to how close you're allowed to get. This is not the case in Norway, which has no laws against swimming with dolphins and whales. The country's whaling laws are also notoriously lax. This makes Norway an alluring destination for orca lovers, but it can also lead to danger for both humans and animals. At one point during my visit, I saw three young tourists from Spain block a pod of orcas with their sailboat, jump into the water, and try to approach by paddleboard. Their tactics scared the orcas into hiding far below the surface. What's more, the Spanish tourists could have ended up stranded out there beyond the fjords, 3 miles from the nearest shoreline, left to the mercy of the fierce Arctic weather and currents. My tour operator, Jacques DeVos, went to great lengths to avoid such situations. DeVos is a South African-born diver who has been studying orcas in this region for the last 7 winters. And has a reputation for being sensitive to the animals and their habitat. DeVos knows how to locate orcas without disturbing the pods or breaking up families. The orcas in this area feed on herring, which they corral into clusters called bait balls. It takes a lot of energy for cold water mammals to orchestrate these feeding sessions, and DeVos makes sure his divers don't get in the way. He uses his radio to stay in touch with nearby researchers so he can stay attuned to the animals' behaviors and help locate individual members of the pods. I went to Norway partly because the COVID-19 pandemic presented unusual reasons to photograph orcas in their element. There were far fewer commercial tours operating, so the animals would be less harassed. More important, as shipping and fishing slowed worldwide, researchers were able to identify more whale and dolphin vocalizations, not only more sounds, but ones they had never heard before. We've been hearing vocalizations that were new to us and different from what we had gotten in the last 6 years, DeVos told me. For lack of a better word, it sounds more energetic. I was eager to feel that energy firsthand. Before DeVos would let me swim with the orcas, I spent a day on board learning about their behavior. He tested my swimming ability, watching me carefully as I dove and climbed back into the boat. weighed down with diving gear. I listened to his instructions. Don't swim aggressively toward the orcas. Move calmly and let them come to you. Don't splash your flippers loudly on the surface or make jerky motions. Before we slid into the water, DeVos played me a recording full of clicks, whistles, and zipper-like sounds. Amazingly, each orca pod uses its own distinct language of notes and tones. Behind the orca conversations, I hear moans of humpback whales. DeVos pays attention to humpbacks, too. They tend to follow orcas and steal their bait balls. Humpbacks can be as large as 50 feet long and weigh over 40 tons. They don't attack humans, but once in a while they inadvertently scoop up divers who get too close to their food. This reportedly happened to a New England lobster diver in June. The whale spat him out and he survived. On the recording DeVos played for me, the humpbacks called to each other in low baritones, ascending the musical scale. DeVos explained that low and high notes travel different distances. A whale will call out to a podmate, and the pitch of the reply may indicate how far away it is. DeVos compares the giant creatures to truck drivers, speaking to each other on different radio channels. I never knew how powerful an orca's sonar pulse could be until I got into the water and felt one reverberate deep in my chest, like the bass at a rock concert. The sensation was so weirdly moving, I hooted through my snorkel. Because when a 6-ton orca swims directly at you and pings you with his echolocution device, trying to identify who and what is swimming in his Arctic hunting waters, you realize you are in a completely alien world. I swam alongside this 25-foot-long male for a few moments. We looked at each other in the eye before he surfaced for breath. His 6-foot dorsal fin broke the water just yards in front of me, and I glimpsed the snow-capped peaks on each side of the fjord before he accelerated back down into the darkness with one swish of his fluke. Through my wetsuit hoodie, I faintly heard a click and a high-pitched whistle. 2 female orcas appeared about 20 feet below me, corralling herring into a bait ball. The pair seemed unbothered as I dove down to get a closer look. They started pushing the herring toward me as if I had arrived to help. Suddenly, the male reemerged from the depths. As he glided next to me, his pectoral fin, nearly the size of my entire body, slid under my stomach. We eyed each other again before he rolled left and swept his dorsal fin, the size of a small plane's tail, just over my head. The stray felt more playful than territorial, like an orca high five, a moment of connection with an enormous, intelligent being in a place where sound is sight and the noisy, natural glory of nature still reigns. When I got back to the surface, I noticed fins all around. Then I caught a flash of white. The humpback baritones had arrived, coming in to steal the orca's lunch. In an instant, herring flashed and scattered as a humpback, mouth ajar, scooped up the majority of the bait ball in a single gulp. It looked like a submarine passing just below my flippers. The early night was exploding in the green and burgundy waves of the northern lights when I met with Eve Jourdain and Richard Karolison, founders of the Norwegian Orca Survey. In the last 7 years, they've used dorsal fin shapes and patterns to identify more than 1,200 of the estimated 3,000 orcas that winter in Norway. This work is crucial. Right now, the International Union for Conservation of Nature classifies orcas as data deficient. Some of their populations might be endangered, but there just isn't enough information to be sure. Karolison and Jourdain are the only researchers in Norway doing this kind of meticulous tracking. Jourdain is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Oslo. Karolison, a Norwegian boat and drone pilot, grew up eating whale meat. I used to see whales as just another fish, he says. Today, I see incredibly intelligent animals. He and Jourdain take blubber biopsies to check the orcas' diets and measure hormonal levels for stress indications. They suspect their data will show a decrease in stress levels during the pandemic. I showed Jourdain the underwater photo I'd taken of the male who'd given me a high five. That's Melvin. He is 25 to 30 years old. He comes every year, she said, and he only eats fish, not seals like some other orcas. Melvin was caught in a fishing net in 2016, she told me. The next day, I joined Jourdain and Carol Lason on their small research boat. In the amber light, they communicated by radio with DeVos and another feed-diving outfitter called Valhalla. By 11:30 a.m., we were following a pod of eight orcas, carefully matching their speed while keeping our distance. The pod kept surfacing near us as we moved steadily southeast. Jourdain photographed individual dorsal fins for the database. A few minutes later, the orca's misty spray was right next to us, just before their bodies slid beneath the water and out of our sight. And now I'm going to go back and read some of the captions. Again, it looks very cold with a snow-covered mountain in the background and villages on a hill on one side of the photo. Arctic nature, top left, a diver swims along the surface where water temperatures hover around 40 degrees Fahrenheit. The bubbles arise from a school of herring. Above, a pod of orcas feed in the dawn light outside the village of Skjervøy on the northern edge of Norway, inside the Arctic Circle. And left, high winds sweep the peaks that form the nation's northernmost fjords. A female orca circles a school of herring. She and her podmates will stun the ball with their tails and eat one fish at a time, filleting each with their tongues and spitting out the bones. Marine life. Top left, a herd of reindeer swim across an inlet, urged on by indigenous Sami shepherds in boats who push the animals to another pasture. Bottom left, Richard Karlsson of the Norwegian Orca Survey. He and marine biologist Yves Jourdain have identified more than 1,200 of the 3,000 orcas that visit the fjords each year. Stormy seas. An orca soars up and plunges back down into the water in a single motion. This method of surfacing, known as porpoising, requires less energy than swimming in the turbulent waves. This next page has a picture of the northern lights, which I'd love to see in person. In this picture, you have a very dark blue sky with very bright green trails. Almost looks like airplane contrails. Northern lights. Bottom, an orca swims off the coastline of Troms and Finnmark County. Though this is the least populated area in Norway, thousands of tourists brave the cold and dark each winter to witness the aurora borealis above and see whales and orcas who come to these waters to feast on overwintering herring. Top right, a female orca waits next to a herring bait ball, letting her podmates take turns feeding. And the photographer for this article was Peter McBride. He focuses on threatened ecosystems. His latest book, Seeing Silence, celebrates the power of natural sounds on all seven continents. Our next story, in the old Route 66 town of Holbrook, Arizona, close to the Navajo Reservation and far from anywhere else, a 41-year-old man named Atsuo Sakurai is making the best sake produced outside Japan. When, by happenstance, I heard about this extraordinary achievement some months ago from a bartender in Los Angeles, I felt compelled to find out how it happened. The road to Holbrook, population 5,000, is long and empty, passed through stark red desert. The sky was enormous, the horizons flung out, and the light exuded a polished, gleaming quality. Wind from carved rocks into hoodoos and goblins. When I got out of the car, the air seemed aggressively arid, as if it was trying to raid the moisture from my body and win the war against plants at the same time. It's hard to imagine an environment more different from the wet, green Japanese islands where the art of fermenting rice into sake has been perfected over 2,400 years. Did Sakurai choose Holbrook, I wondered, or wash up there on the tides of fate? Is he viewed as an eccentric? What do the locals make of him, and vice versa? Where does he source his rice? How far does his finished product have to travel before it reaches the nearest sake connoisseur? How does the desert climate affect the making and flavor of the sake? I had never tasted expensive high-grade sake before, which prompted another question. How delicious can a drink made from fermented rice and rice mold really be? Arriving at last in Holbrook, I was struck by the prevalence of giant roadside dinosaur sculptures, rock shops selling petrified wood souvenirs, and abandoned buildings. The wind whipped up miniature tornadoes of dust along the railroad tracks. There was a general air of faded Americana. I drove down Bucket of Blood Street, which commemorates a notorious mass killing in a local saloon in 1886. I took a snapshot of a charming landmark, a motel where guests still check into a compound of 1950s concrete wigwams. Early from my appointment with Sakurai, I was pleased to find a bottle of his Arizona sake at a drive-through liquor store with a vintage neon sign. "Make sure you keep it cold or it'll spoil," the woman at the window advised as she swiped my credit card for $51.15. "And tell Atsuo Hey, he's a real sweet guy, and we're proud of him for putting Holbrook on the map." I looked at the bottle and the clear liquid inside. The label described it as a Junmei Jingo Sake, a raw, unpasteurized, unfiltered style made only from rice, water, yeast, and the grain fungus known as koji, K-O-J-I. I was eager to sample it, although I doubted it would taste as good as a $51 bottle of wine. The precise location of the sake house at Sakurai, described it by email, eluded the navigation app in my smartphone. But after driving up and down Navajo Boulevard a few times, I spotted a tiny handmade sign on a big empty lot between the Dollar General and the Super 8 Motel. It said, AZ Sake, Private. 100 yards behind the sign, surrounded by bare dirt, stood a small white building. It looked newly constructed and had no windows. Atsuo Sakurai, 41 years old, greeted me at the front door, wearing a tweed sport coat, jeans, and a Route 66 baseball cap. He didn't strike me as an eccentric, although he agreed that Holbrook, Arizona, was a very odd place for a Japanese sake master to ply his trade. There were a few Japanese expats married to Americans in northeast Arizona, he said, but no Japanese community. As far as he knew, he was the only certified first-grade sake brewer in the United States, and he felt very fortunate to live in tiny Holbrook, because this is where his American dream came true. "In Japan, I cannot be free," he said in a slow, careful English. "I cannot make my own sake because there are too many government regulations. Here in Arizona, I am my own boss, and this is why I came to America, for freedom and independence. My friends in Holbrook say I am a samurai in a cowboy hat, or that I wear a cowboy hat like a samurai helmet. I love this. As a teenager in the city of Yokohama, a part of Greater Tokyo, the most populous metropolitan area on Earth with more than 37 million inhabitants, Sakurai had no concept of Arizona, no dreams of coming to America, and no interest in sake. He wanted to fight climate change and plastic pollutants as an environmental activist. Then he went away to college to Tohoku University in northern Japan, where he studied agricultural sciences and discovered the allure of alcohol. "I had a great time with sake and liquor and the guys," he told me. "You probably think we were drinking like crazy." "Sometimes, yes, but mostly we were drinking very gently. Graduates would take us to sophisticated bars and pubs. We were fortunate to experience good sake. Eventually, I got interested in how to make it." He took a course on the history and production of sake at the university, taught by the owner of a famous sake company. At the end of the term, Sakurai bested the other students in a blind tasting contest to identify commercial sakes, the first of his many awards. After graduation in the spring of 2005, he landed a job in a sake factory in the northern city of Akita and learned the trade from the bottom up. "I started out cleaning floors, tools, walls, windows, tanks, and maintaining equipment and machines. Those jobs are boring, but I knew to be very, very important. Contamination can be a big problem." The sake master at the factory, Tadashi Ito, recognized Akari's diligence and curiosity and began mentoring him. "It is difficult to teach sake making by oral communication," Sakurai recalled, "but Ito let me work with him and I absorbed his philosophy. To make good sake, it is important to love nature as it is. He was patient, like an oak tree covered in piles of snow, and his manufacturing was careful, thoughtful, never cutting corners." After 3 years, Sakurai rose to a fairly senior position and started giving 30-minute tours of the facility to visitors in both Japanese and English. One day in 2008, a 25-year-old Navajo American woman living in Japan and teaching English arrived at the factory for a tour. Her name was Heather Bassinger, and her hometown was Holbrook, Arizona. "I thought she was honest. I don't know what she thought," was all that Sakurai had to say about their first encounter. When I reached her on the phone, Bassinger was more forthcoming. "It was a feeling right off the bat. I just knew," she said. "My sister was with me that day, and she noticed it too. It was love at first sight." Sakurai and Bassinger moved up to Niigata and the west coast of Japan's main island, where they married and had two of their three children. Bassinger's mother and aunt flew over from Arizona to help with the babies and meet Sakurai's relatives. Both families were supportive of the unusual match. The Niigata region is well known for its sake, and Sakurai joined a local company. "I was still learning sake with trial and error," he said. "There is an annual competition in Niigata, and the first year my sake was rated 120th among 150 others. But I made progress every year until I won third place. It was a big accomplishment, but I had already made a resolution to come to the States to seek independence." From the very outset of his career, Sakurai's ambition was to run his own sake company. For this reason, he had taught himself how to manage a boiler system, drive a forklift, understand fuel systems, treat wastewater, and do his own accounting and perform any skills he would need as an independent producer. In Niigata, having completed the required 7 years of training, he passed the exam that certified him as a first-grade brewer. But he was unable to get a government license to make sake. He still gets angry and frustrated when he talks about the bureaucratic impediments. "There is no opportunity to be an entrepreneur," he declares. "The government says there are enough sake companies, so they won't give any new licenses. If you have $1 million, you can purchase an existing sake business, but I didn't have $1 million. In Japan, I would always have to work for an established company and obey the strict government rules about how sake must be made. No innovations are allowed. In 2014, the Sakurai family left Japan and made the long journey to Holbrook. Basinger was glad to come home, but Sakurai was shocked by the smallness and remoteness of the town, the lack of business infrastructure, and the climate. It seemed impossible to make sake in a desert, so he moved the family to damp coastal Oregon near Portland, where the climate is similar to Japan's. The plan was simple, he explained. Find a house to live in and start making sake there. But we needed permits from the neighborhood and the city council, and we had no connections for financing or anything else. They weren't going to give a permit for a liquor business to some alien guy from somewhere else. So they returned to Holbrook. Basinger got a job teaching at a local school, and Sakurai grew despondent. He was unemployed with no business opportunities in a place that seemed completely unsuitable for making sake. One summer day in 2016, he was watching his children play in a local park, brooding about his problems, increasingly sure that he would have to try again in the Pacific Northwest, when a local man came and sat down next to him. His companion was easy to talk to, a good listener. Sakurai explained that he wanted to start a sake business, but needed somewhere with good water and a climate similar to Japan. The man said, "Why not do your sake here? We have a big aquifer and the water is good. Maybe that's all you need." It was a moment of revelation. His words blew away the fog and let in the light. If he was not there in the park that day, I'm not sure I would still be in Arizona. Sakurai began filling out license applications and modifying his garage into a small, rudimentary production facility. He had no water lines in the space, no room to install large equipment, but he was able to run electricity to the garage so that he could control room temperatures. The Holbrook City Council was supportive when he presented his proposal. He was granted a permit in January 2017. Tasting his first 50-gallon batch made with Calrose rice from California and Holbrook City water, Sakurai was delighted with it. Purity is the goal of a sake maker, and in humid Japan, this means constant vigilance against unwanted molds, yeasts, germs, and other living contaminants. In the parched air of northern Arizona, these age-old problems evaporated, he discovered. It was easy to brew fresh, clean, pure sake. That was Ode to an Orca. That's going to wrap up our time for today. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their continued support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.